You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
I don't think there's any money to be made, really, in, like, selling music, honestly.
And without anyone sitting down and spelling it out for us, we realized music was becoming freely shareable.
They don't play the song on the radio. They don't show that it's on the radio. They don't know that we are the media. They don't know that we start the media. I don't want to see what I'm making you. I see some big seat and I'm taking you. Walking down the street, I'm the lady. Showing off my map of Tasmania.
The music business may look like it's facing a tough time, but individual artists are having more fun than ever, creating music, connecting with their fans, and yes, even making a living. Today we speak with two artists, Amanda Palmer and Donald Glover, about how they're remaking the music business in their own image. Amanda Palmer has been active in the music industry for over a decade. She is known for having a flair for the dramatic. In fact, I should make sure I get her name right.
Amanda fucking Palmer. To the uninitiated.
Someone get that out of the way.
Performing and recording for more than 10 years with the Dresden Dolls and also solo has not made Amanda F. Palmer complacent. In fact, she's innovating more than ever. Last year, her self-released Amanda Palmer Performs the Popular Hits of Radiohead on her magical ukulele earned her accolades from critics and fans who could download the album from Amanda's site at cost for a minimum donation of 84 cents, 54 cents for royalties to Radiohead and 30 cents for PayPal transaction fees. Amanda just released her latest album, Amanda Palmer Goes Down Under, featuring a mix of live songs and studio tunes related to the continent of Australia. The album was released through her own company, Post War Trade, and on Bandcamp, a site that helps independent musicians sell their music and merchandise with very low transaction fees. Amanda Palmer recently stopped by Radio Berkman to talk to David Weinberger.
You are you're basically giving away lots and lots of music. Now, there's a little twist on that, but basically you're giving away lots and lots of music. Is this for business reasons, for political reasons, for artistic cultural reasons? Why?
A lot of how I run my business is very impulsive. And the way I run my business is very much like the way I make art. I kind of do first and think later. And it may be interesting to go back to the early days of the Dresden Dolls. We were started as a band in 2000. And we were signed by a label not until 2004. In between, I think, was a really, really interesting turning period in what happened with the CD and the shareability of music, because it was right in that time that we bought a CD burner and started giving our music away to people easily on CD, and also noticed that computers, laptops were coming with CD burners. And without anyone sitting down and spelling it out for us, we realized that music was becoming freely shareable. That happened sort of right around the point that I was also trying to sign the band onto a major label. But my philosophy going into signing a contract with a major label is that we can give anyone our music anyway. And what I'm going to want to get out of this record contract is hopefully a whole lot of promotion. I'll probably never make any money, but hopefully this trade will be worth it. And our hands will never be tied the way, say, someone 10 years ago would have had their hands tied with an album that simply didn't get distributed, got put on a shelf in a locker, and all of a sudden you had made this incredible record that where you were very proud of the songs and very proud of the production, and you literally couldn't give it to your next-door neighbor to listen to. This had changed.
You know, not everybody in the world agrees with that, right? There are people who...
Which is just silly when you think about it.
You know, there were people who there are people who are greedy, and we'll put them to one side. Right? We'll just leave them out of this for the moment. But there are people who think that there is that getting paid, a strict correlation between getting paid for your work and the work is moral. It's the right thing.
There's a lot of artists who believe that.
So how do you explain that?
I don't think it's ridiculous for an artist to have the emotion or the whatever, the general philosophy, like, well, I did something. I worked my ass off. Why shouldn't I get paid for it? That's a practical way to think, and it certainly makes sense. How that fits in with reality obviously gets really complicated. The way I've always looked at it, I think I fundamentally believe that as well, but I'm never going to demand of my audience or demand of the world that I get paid. That's as ridiculous as an artist saying, like, it doesn't matter that my art is bad. I made it and someone should fucking buy it. No one would ever really sound reasonable saying that. So why does it sound reasonable? The question, of course, comes up is like, what price tag do you put on an artist's time and energy? And there's so many interesting questions that come up, especially because sometimes even those same artists are the ones saying, like, well, they're really, this doesn't have any real price tag. This is priceless. This is my art. You know, this is my time and energy. You could look at that and say, well, someone has to pay for it, but maybe no one has to pay for it. And what I'm always jockeying for is for artists to simply be realistic about this whole mess and complications of all of these complicated questions and ask, can I make a living? And maybe it's a complicated answer, but maybe there isn't some giant philosophical exclamation point at the end of this sentence. Maybe it really just is, art is complicated, commerce is complicated. How can we, with the tools that we happen to have right now in 2010 and 2011, how can I as an artist make a living? That's a very unromantic, unpassionate question for an artist to ask, but that's the question.
So you talk about faith-based, but you're actually, this is an intensely realistic based, realism-based approach. There's another possible answer to the question, which is there are some who, some artists who would say, no, I actually don't have any form of moral ownership of what I've done. People don't actually owe me for the value that I've delivered to them. That's not the way culture works. That's not the way art works. Mm-hmm. And so they have given up on any sort of moral claim to ownership. Your answer seems to be a little different. Well, actually quite different, which is, yeah, maybe you have that moral claim, but it's just not a realistic way for an artist to make a living these days.
That's an interesting question. I think that's not quite right either. For me, this is really interesting. It always comes back to street performance. You never want to demand that someone put a dollar in your guitar case as a busker. But you want to make it very easy for people to do it, and you want to thank them when they do. And somewhere in between, there's this magic thing that happens where someone stops, listens, and puts the dollar in. That's where the faith comes in.
When you were a busker, if somebody stood and they listened for one song, and then they listened for two songs, they listened for three songs.
I should point out, I wasn't a musical busker. I was a living statue.
Really?
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I thought about taking a keyboard out into the street and playing my songs, and I was far too terrified because my music was so personal, and I didn't think I could handle the kind of, the masses of people walking by and ignoring my music the way I could handle masses of people walking by and ignoring me standing there as a statue. But the model is similar. People would come by and watch me for 10 minutes and enjoy my presence and talk about me and simply walk away.
How did you feel about that? Was there any sense of, damn it, they really should have put a buck in?
Well, especially with people taking photographs. Yeah, I mean, if an entire family with three kids came up to me And each of their kids posed for a photograph with me. And the parents, you know, had this whole 5-minute experience and their kids thought it was really cool. And this whole thing played out and I gave them my time and attention and they walked away without putting in a dollar. Yeah, I would feel ripped off.
So there's your moral claim. Do you ever feel that way about music? The music that you're giving away, basically?
No, not as much, because when people take my music for free, I still feel flattered that they even want it. And I always figure I'm no worse off that this person took, you know, that family of five that came up actually took up my time and energy. Anyone downloading my music from BitTorrent, they're not costing me any time and energy. And they may very possibly go on to share that music with the next person who may go on to share it with someone who may go on to share it with 100 people, and you never know where things are going to lead. And that one person who might have, you know, downloaded my music, made a comment to a friend that then started a giant ripple effect that ultimately ends with people actually donating money to me, actually coming to see me play live, actually really getting involved with me. It's never a negative thing, ever. How could it possibly be?
Because I will be the picture of discipline, never minding what state I'm in. And I will be someone I admire. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but it does not seem to have happened. Maybe I've just forgotten how to see that I'm not exactly the person that I thought I'd be.
Explain the 84 cents for the Radiohead uke covers.
That is very simply a combination of the PayPal transaction fee and the cost to me for covering five Radiohead songs, which at about 9 cents a song plus the PayPal transaction fee to garner that 9 cents per song, all added up to about 84 cents.
So that's not a symbolic.
It's not symbolic.
It was just
it's literally the cost. Literally the cost of the transaction.
Although it does have the effect of getting somebody already into the PayPal payment screens, which makes it must make it much easier for somebody to say, you know what, actually, I can do a little better than 84 cents.
Absolutely. And interestingly, I was really kind of disheartened when I realized that I was going to come in at a loss if I gave this record away for free, because I was going to have to pay Radiohead the publishing money when I decided to do a covers project. But it actually, I think, wound up really working to my benefit, because had I given away the record purely for free with a, and if you want to donate, stick the amount in here, I think I certainly wouldn't have made as much money. I might have, but it's doubtful, because I think once people are there paying 84 cents, they're much more likely to say, ah, and I'll give her a buck, or I'll give her $5, or you know what, I've downloaded all the Dresden Dolls records, I'll give her $20, because I've been enjoying her music for 5 years and I've never paid her, here, I'll kick her back. And those people may not have made that step in their minds had they just had the option to download the record for free.
You have lots of different things going on, webby things going on. How much of what you do is specific to you? And how much of this, if you had to make recommendations or change the industry in a particular way, what's generalizable from this?
I'd like to think that what is generalizable is a trust that people really do want to actively support artists that they enjoy. And they have to be given opportunities, enjoyable opportunities maybe, to do that. These are really exciting times that we're living in, and I don't think anyone would argue with that. And giving music listeners, art appreciators, blog readers, book readers, the opportunity to connect with and contribute to, whether it's with time, energy, or money, the artists and the authors that they enjoy is not, I don't think it's as crazy as some people might make it out to be, because as I have found moving through the world, meeting many, many people, they are delighted by and inspired by the idea of being able to directly contribute to the people whose art affects their day, their drive to work, their time at home, their relationships. So I'd love to see a world in which there's a shift in the paradigm of the way people think about free content. You know, the internet is free content. You read, you know, everything you read on the internet is basically up there for free. But if there was an easy way, when you got to the end of a blog, to say, wow, I spent 45 minutes reading this and it was really enlightening, and I could simply click here and donate 30 cents to this person, of course I'll do it. I'd love to see the world change towards a kind of an honor system like that, where people are happy to treat all of the content kind of as busking content. I think that would be great.
And why would that be better than,
you can go than through monetizing iTunes. Everything?
I'm asking this naively. Yeah. You know, but you can make a semi-micro, I mean, it's a buck a song at iTunes. Why would it be better to be on the honor system than to be on a sort of, yeah, micro payments? You pay for what you get, and you got to pay the buck or the 30 cents. Is that for economic reasons? Is it for artistic reasons? Or
I think it's both. I don't claim to be an expert in how digital content is going to wangle its way into the future. But from what I can guess, content is going to continue to be free and available. And I'd rather see doors open than close, because I think it will make the world a better, more creative, more interesting place.
Well, so let me ask specifically, how does the trust, because you have a very strong trust relationship with your listeners.
Yeah.
They trust that you are not going to lie to them, that you're not going to rip them off, that if you say it costs 9 cents per track for Radiohead songs, that's what it costs. Right. How does that trust relationship change your art?
When I sit down to write a song, I don't have an agenda. I get ideas, I go to the piano, I see what comes out, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking, oh, people are really going to like this, people really aren't going to like that, I should change it. I basically just, transmit whatever's coming into my head through the piano, make something that sounds good to me, and then throw it out into the universe, hoping that it's going to resonate with people. But I don't really feel like a pop artist whose job it is to find the perfect 3-minute pop song that is going to make everyone get up and shake their ass and dance, and that is going to be the hit of the summer. I pretty much put out really, really personal stuff that I hope possibly will hit chords with people, but mostly I'm in business to create what sounds good to me. Most of my stuff is pretty, I wouldn't call myself an avant-garde artist. I mean, most of my stuff is pretty palatable. I certainly wouldn't call myself a pop artist either. But I do feel like whatever I make, I trust that it will find some kind of audience. Because if I like it, my assumption is someone else out there will like it. By the same token, I like the idea that if I put my music out there, or digital content out there, for people to enjoy, donate on, you know, if I create some kind of system, it's the same sort of system that I, as a music fan or as a listener to someone else's record or reader of someone else's book or blog, would want, you know, I'm kind of hoping to create the sort of experience for people that I would want to have myself. I don't think of the audience as this enemy or this other that I'm going to have to sort of figure out, learn how to please, and learn how to manipulate. as crazy as it may sound to some people, I'm not really in it to make a profit. I'm really, really happy to be able to make a living. And as long as I can make a comfortable living making art and touring around and never really having to worry about my rent, how I'm going to pay for my dinner, whether I'm going to be able to afford this stuff that I need, all of the details of how I could be making more money or capitalizing on this or that are usually secondary to the actual real-time experience I'm having that day with my fans on the internet at the show that I'm playing in the recording studio. I want to be enjoying my time, my day, and my life, not necessarily sitting around trying to figure out how to maximize my audience or maximize my profits.
Are you happy? How's it working out for you?
It's working out really well. I mean, I have to say, especially lately, like in the last few years, it's been really interesting because I've also had exposure to some of the behind the scenes of the bigger workings of the pop industry and huge artists who are selling millions of records. And it's certainly, if it was ever true before, I believe it more than ever, which is that the quality of your life has very little to do with those numbers. And if you, you know, if you're disconnected from your fans, your process, therefore, I think it's to some extent yourself, it doesn't matter if you're selling 6 million records, you know, your day is probably not as enjoyable and the quality of your life probably isn't either.
Sort of what life in a non-mass world looks
yeah.
like.
Yeah, which isn't to say, which isn't to say that you can't be mega successful and known by the world and selling millions, billions of records and be at peace. I think that really is possible. But you certainly, the success certainly does not buy the happiness. And I think it often comes at the cost of happiness when, you know, especially when you've got young artists who really, you know, have a really, really, you know, fucked up way of looking at their futures, thinking that the success will buy them freedom, happiness, even artistic freedom and happiness. And then when you find out those things aren't true, it can really be devastating.
What vision of success are you heading him towards?
Oh, that's really interesting. We did a clinic at Berkeley, and I found myself answering this question for someone in the audience during a Q&A who were, you know, asking me and Tristan, so what's your definition of making it? And, you know, nowadays I think making it has to be redefined, because it really has been literally redefined. To be a superstar nowadays is not only completely unrealistic, it doesn't even really work anymore. We don't live in a blockbuster economy, and it would be to everybody's benefit if younger artists and younger musicians got used to the idea of making it as, I don't have to have a day job, and I am able to make my living making art, and that in itself is making it. And it is not symbolized by a gigantic limo pulling up at my door and taking me to, you know, like the hookers and blow on the mountain. Like, it's just a different kind of mindset. And I think, you know, this isn't new. I mean, DIY artists, like, starting back in the early days, I mean, even in the 80s with just, like, punk labels, you know, looking at this whole system and saying the system is fucked. These bands want to play. These people love them. Let's put out our own records and just hit the road in a van and do it. But to be able to apply that to every genre of music and to all sorts of different kinds of artists, that's definitely, you know, that's going to be what the future of a big collection of working class musicians is going to be made up of. And I'll be very happy to see that happen.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks for asking such awesome questions.
I'm a pale intruder on an unknown beach. My back to the water, my feet in the sand. Finding no recognition as each sign of the precision of this aging land.
And our next guest is also a musician using the internet to share his work, but coming from a slightly different background. You might recognize this guy starring opposite Joel McHale on the hit NBC show Community.
You see what I'm saying? You're saying I could be a lawyer.
I'm saying you're a football player. It's in your blood.
That's racist.
Your soul.
That's racist.
Your eyes.
That's gay.
That's homophobic.
That's black.
That's racist.
But you might not know that the owner of that voice, Donald Glover, is actually more than just an actor. He's one of those rare quintuple threats in the entertainment industry in that he's been a stand-up comic, a writer for, among other things, NBC's 30 Rock, a co-founder of the sketch comedy group Derek, and the proprietor of a musical alter ego.
How should I refer to you? Should it be Donald or MC DJ or Childish Gambino? Or?
Donald's fine.
Childish Gambino, doper than 20 kilos, feeling me no albino, pardon me, that's my ego.
As MC DJ and Childish Gambino, Donald Glover has released at least 11 different albums worth of music, original mixes, remixes, and rap, all released completely free over the internet. And when I say free, I mean seriously free. There's no PayPal link, no sponsorship message, no copyright notice. Donald releases his music straight over a file-sharing network, which he promotes through Blogspot and Tumblr sites. I caught up with Donald to talk about how he got into music and how he feels about sharing his music freely.
I always really, really liked music. I took guitar as a kid. My dad was always, like, you know, playing, like, I don't know, like George Clinton when I was little, and Kraftwerk and stuff, and really eclectic stuff. Like, I never, like, he always left the pop stuff. He was like, you'll hear that on the radio. But, like, I remember being a little kid and him playing, like, Thomas Dolby for me and me loving it. And I took dance. I was at a performing arts high school, but I had never really learned music. And then I got really into it in college. Just, it was always, you know, we were making a lot of sketch shows and doing a lot of sketch shows when you wanted to, like, you know, have a feeling or, like, you have, like, there's a lot of genre, you know, a lot of playing with genre and sketch because you're always doing different stuff. So they would always turn to me, and I started, you know, messing around on my computer on, like, Fruity Loops, and then I upgraded and I got a DJ set, and I started messing with Logic, and it just kind of grew from this kind of necessity of just, like, we were doing it for sketch, and I also really enjoyed it, and I found out I just started doing it on my off time. So that's pretty much it. Yeah, I just kind of grew out of nowhere.
So you started off doing music as something that was just kind of a hobby and extracurricular, you know, but also related to your work in comedy. But was there ever a point where, with your music, where people started hearing it and saying, hey, you know, I want to have that guy perform, you know, on Friday night at my club, or, like, I want to have that guy, you know, do beats for my soundtrack or something like that?
I think, like, yeah, a lot of people would always, like, after a couple of, like, mixtapes I had put out, people would always come over, like, hey, you know, this is good stuff, you know, you need to take it to the next step. And and people are always, actually, the last time Derek was out, we did some stuff, and people asked about MC DJ and the soundtrack, and they're like, when are you going to start doing that for real? And we always kind of laugh at that, because I was like, oh, well, I am doing it for real, you know, kind of, and that's just something I enjoy doing. I never kind of looked at it as a job because I just love doing it so much. Like, whenever I get off time, I'm usually in front of the computer just, like, listening to other music, seeing what parts I could loop and add this to it and that to it. People are like, oh, you should get a producer, you know, you should try and sell that on iTunes. It's pretty easy. But, like, you know, I like the fact that people can just pick it up and get it for free. Like, you know, and then that's how you build a fan base. You know, people, you know, really respond to that. So, for people saying, when am I going to do it for real? I feel like I am doing it for real. I'm just, you know, enjoying it.
When did you decide to release your music for free? I mean, was that just an instinct? Was that just a natural thing? Like, I want to get this out there and let people hear it? Or were you, you know, was there ever a point where you said, oh, maybe I should be selling this on iTunes? People seem to be liking it.
It was always kind of like, you know, it was always kind of born out of necessity. I feel like all the best stuff is kind of born out of that kind of stuff. We, like, a lot with, like, the Derek videos, the sketch group, I'm in the comedy, like, a lot of people were like, how did you get the idea to start putting stuff on YouTube? Because YouTube was such a good idea to start putting stuff on YouTube early. And it really just came out, we were going to put them out on our own, but we just didn't have the bandwidth. Like, we were just some college kids, and we didn't have the money for the bandwidth. And I remember, like, Dominic coming in and being like, hey, this YouTube thing is coming out. I just heard about this YouTube thing. We can be able to, like, upload as many videos as we want. We were like, okay. And it just so happened to foster a community. We were very fortunate, but it also kind of rose out of this necessity to get the stuff out there. And I think that's basically what I felt with the albums. I always kind of felt, like, from, like, our sketch shows, because the sketch shows we did were free as well. And I had a friend of mine tell me, he's like, you know, he was a director, and he was like, you know, it's really important. It's good that you guys make these shows free in college, because people will come in with a mindset of like, well, I pay $5 for this. This better be good. But when it's free, you know, you're more willing to listen to what it is. And I felt, you know, I was going to try and do something weird and new. You know, I always try and do something like a little different. And I knew, like, with Childish Gambino, I'd be rapping about, you know, like, pink sweaters and what I like to wear, and I don't like wearing jewelry, and, like, all that kind of stuff. I wanted to explore that, and I knew people would be more willing to listen to my argument if they didn't pay, you know, a dollar song.
Right, so if they were paying a dollar for the song, they'd say, you know what, I don't know about this guy. He seems to be saying some strange stuff.
Yeah, I don't think I want to hear about pink sweaters for a dollar, you know? I think I'll keep that dollar, you know? I do appreciate it, because then it finds an audience, and then those people can tell their friends they know will be interested, and, you know, and it's still free. So, you know, as long as the music's getting out there, I'm happy.
So dope, my hood is so tight, my hoodie it's cool, cause my hood is so bright.
So the music, you're not only distributing the music for free. I looked all over the, you know, your site, and I looked all over, you know, the file sharing spaces where your music was available for download, and I couldn't find a single copyright notice. And I don't know, I mean, in the United States, of course, if you, you know, copyright is kind of the default, so your music is, you know, owned by you, if
right.
your name is on it, but, you know, I wonder if you've thought about that, or if that's something you've thought about consciously, of, like, how you feel about, you know, the ownership of your music.
I always felt, you know, like, that the music I make is just, like, especially with the MC DJ albums, which are made from, like, samples of songs and stuff like that. It's just like, you know, that's just out there. Like, that's just something I heard in the song, and I really liked it, and I wasn't trying to own it and be like, oh, I listened to this, and I ripped it, and then I made this, you know. I always felt that if it becomes that big, or if just somebody takes it, you know, before that, like, if somebody, a lot of people will email me and be like, yo, I heard your song here, and he's like, that's BS, this song is not, like, actually on one of the albums, of instrumental albums, it came out on there was an instrumental I had, and then it was on, I think, the Kingdom Come album, that Jay-Z, like, that same, like, kind of hook, like, had looped in the exact same way. And people were like, yo, Jay-Z stole your thing. And I was like, Jay-Z did not steal my thing. Like, I was like, I'm not going to go for that. Like, I'm not the type of person to really get petty over beats. Like, music is, like, I really believe it's a very, like, you know, kind of like secular thing. Like it grows and it comes back and things are used again and again and again. A lot like comedy, where people will be like, "Oh, that bit, you know, Steve Martin did that bit better." It's like, well, they're all the same bit. Like they're all the same bit. Like, you know, you're still laughing, you know, a joke about, you know, somebody's private parts. You're still laughing about a fart. You're still laughing. You know, it's just about the way it's done. It's about the flair, you know.
Steve Martin says something about that in his in the book Born and Standing Up. He said that he came out and he wanted to do something completely original. And I don't know if he actually succeeded in that, but it sounds like almost a hopeless endeavor to try to do something completely original. You're always referencing something.
You're always referencing something, especially now when with the internet, information is so fluid. Like, you're always being exposed to new stuff and new things, you know, and just like, and a lot of people being like, "Oh, these guys were innovators." Like, they were just like creative, talented people who were exposed to something that most people weren't exposed to early. Like a lot of people, like, you know, Michael Jackson did not invent the moonwalk, but he definitely did it the biggest. You know, he definitely brought it to the forefront. You know, other people had done it, but we hadn't been exposed to it, and we hadn't been exposed to it through somebody as good as him. You know, like I feel that way with music. It's just like, it's not about what you're rapping about. You know, Lil Wayne raps about the same stuff every rapper raps about: sex, drugs, money. But he does it in a way that is so new and different, and so different from everybody else doing a lot of rapping now, that he stands out. You know, I think that's kind of the point of music.
You're listening to Radio Berkman, a special all-music edition. I'm speaking to actor, writer, comedian Donald Glover, who also raps and produces music under the names MC DJ and Childish Gambino. Donald shares his music freely on the web, free as in beer, and free as in speech. He doesn't claim any copyright over his songs. And in some cases, he simply can't.
In one of your releases, or actually, I think you did two releases that were... actually, remixes of copyrighted music. You had a Fiona Apple remix, I think, and a Sir John Stevens. When you were doing those, what were you thinking in terms of the licenses for the music? And was anybody coming to you saying, "Hey, like, I notice you're doing this. Maybe you want to, you know, watch out for the record companies"?
No, I never really thought they would get as far as they did. I honestly, it just started from a place of, like, I remember listening to Sir John Stevens' album, being like, "Oh, those melodies are really beautiful." Like, I'd make a good rap song if I looped it, and then I looped that one and made a beat under it, and I rapped over it, and I was like, this other one would be dope too. And then I ended up making like three in a night, and then I was like, okay, well, I'll just make the whole album, because that was really fun. And I ended up doing that, and I didn't know it was going to get around as fast as it, until like somebody from Adult Swim like emailed me and was like, "Yeah, hey, really liked your album, just wanted to let you know." And I was like, it's just been out for like a week. You know, so, and I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about the repercussions, you know, but, you know, I remember around the time I was doing that, a lot of stuff like the Gray album had just come out with the Jay-Z Black album and the White album remix. And I was like, you know, if that's not going to get that guy, you know, and put that guy in jail for years, then I don't think me doing a Sir John Stevens remix is going to, you know, get me incarcerated.
There's like an aspect of being a musician. You got to make money. You know, this is your full-time job, obviously for you,
right.
You've made a name for yourself, outside of music. I wondered how music kind of fits into your career plan.
I never really like thought of it as using it, but like, it was actually the other day some friends of mine were talking about, you know, this business, you can't really do this kind of stuff forever. You can't really, you know, I can't be, an actor or the type of actor, you know, it's kind of fleeting. It'll definitely end. And, you know, there's some things you just can't do forever. But I felt like music, or just like doing that, you can always be behind the scenes. I love writing too. I can write forever, you know. I can do music forever. And I was, you know, after doing Mystery Team score, that was like one of the most fulfilling and joyful experiences of my life. I was like, I could probably, you know, if I really wanted to just like, you know, every summer just start learning how to actually score it and not just do the whole thing by, you know, by ear and stuff, but like scoring movies, you know, that was, you know, I felt like it's a very, like, it's kind of the long con of the industry, I feel. So I don't know. I hope like music becomes like a major part of my life, is not just like a hobby.
This is kind of a presumptuous question, but what is it you think that people like about your music?
That it's free.
It's more than that. It's got to be more than that. I can go out and get free music. I could be making music, but I don't think people would be, you know, hey, it's free, I might as well listen to it.
Hopefully it's the same thing they like about, you know, other stuff that I do. It's just that, you know, they're not seeing it other places. Like, I'd like to think, you know, that you're not finding a rapper who's, you know, rapping about the stuff I'm rapping about, just because, like, you know, I didn't grow up in the inner city. I grew up like in the suburbs, and you know, I was pretty much taken care of them, but I was afraid of things just like, you know, a kid in the city would be afraid of things. And you know, and I hope people like the DJ albums, because like they're loops that they wouldn't find everywhere else, you know, or I'm using samples or melodies that I really, you know, are close to me, like. And I think like it just takes a point of view on a lot of things, a specific point of view, you know, whether it be comedy or music, it's all about the point of view. You know, I enjoy Chris Rock's jokes because they're all from his point of view. They're so him. You know, I enjoy Jay-Z because they're so him. I enjoy, you know, Kanye, Lady Gaga, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, whoever's making something, I will invest in it if it's true to that person, because I can't be them. I can only see through their lens, which is really awesome. So I like to think that people like my stuff because it's different, and I'm the only one kind of shedding light on through that point of view.
Do you think if you had an album that came out and suddenly broke into the top 40, would you still think of releasing that album free?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any money to be made really in like selling music, honestly. Like, and not to sound like an anarchist or some sort of crazy like thing, but like music is like the second you put something out, somebody can rip it. It's easy. Like, there are kids who have never paid for music a day in their lives. Like, they just haven't. It's so easy. Like, I can buy an album and then rip it for all my friends and just get it. Like, anytime I hear a song on the radio, I can get it for free. It's very easy. But it's not about that. I mean, if you're really in it for the right reasons, I feel it's just like, okay, that song, people really like it. And if they really really like what I'm doing and support me, then I'll go on tour live and they'll come see me. And if that's the way I want to make money, I can definitely make it on the road. You know, I think the internet has really, like, stripped the middleman from a lot of the entertainment industry, like, you know, as far as, like, there is no, I don't have to, if I wanted to make a short movie or a sketch, there are cheap cameras I can buy, and then I can put them up online, and if people like it, then I can get money straight from them instead of having to ask a producer to fund what I'm doing, you know. And it's the same thing with music. I feel like if you have the means, make that music. If people respond, go straight to them. There's no reason to hope and pray that somebody with money thinks it's good. And, you know, I don't think there's any reason you have to prove yourself anymore. You can just do what you need to do and see if there's any sort of reaction, which I feel is like a truer version, a truer way of doing it.
Same scenario. If your next album comes out and you just hit it really big with it, how do you feel about how your music gets shared and remixed and used in other forms? There's been a lot of cases where, you know, a musician will hit it really big and, you know, every company will want to license it for a commercial or something like that. But if you're releasing music, you know, free of license, then technically, you know, a company could use it or take it and put it into their, you know, their commercial.
Right. I mean, that is a slippery slope. It is a strange thing. It's just like, you know, I want my music to be everywhere. I wouldn't mind, you know, if it was like in an iPod commercial, but if it's in a commercial for, you know, like, you know, something awful, you know, something that I just would, I don't condone or anything like that. Or just like, you know, if I saw it in a, if I saw it in a Girls Gone Wild story, I'd be like, oh no, you know, like, but like, you know, that I think that's just, you know, the other side of the coin. That's what you do, you know, you kind of have to take the good with the bad. Like, that's just change. That's everything. You know, you kind of take that gamble with everything. I would hate it, but, you know, I put that music out there and it was free and they used it, you know, and hopefully, you know, maybe you'll get people who'll be like, hopefully you'll be like, oh, I really hate that Girls Gone Wild commercial, but the music they used. You
know. You'll have fans coming up to you after the show and say, hey, you know, I got into you through the Girls Gone Wild video. I just
just want to say it's great.
It's a great work. I yeah. really love your work. Thanks, Donald.
No problem, man.
And this next part sounds like nonsense, but I swear to God, Tina Fey gave me confidence. Taught me everything that is good comes from honesty. Everybody's got a voice, you just gotta follow it. She on a role model shit. From the day that I shook her hand, I knew that I'd never die a broke man. So I could try this rapping shit out again. The game need change, I'm a part of it. People tell me I should spit under Donald Glover, but I try to keep my real name undercover, cause if you hear my name, then you think it's jokes.
Donald Glover is the real name of rapper-producer Childish Gambino. He's written for 30 Rock, he's a co-founder of the sketch comedy group Derek, and he currently stars on the NBC sitcom Community. And all of his music is available for free through his website, childishgambino.com. We'll have links to more about both of today's guests, Amanda Palmer and Donald Glover, up on our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. There you can also find out more about our Rethink Music series and the Rethink Music Conference coming up later this spring here in Boston. Today's show was produced by yours truly, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger and help from Amar Asher, Alan Bargfried, and Chris Babbitts. From the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.